Stan Hieronymus joins me this week to discuss New Zealand hops. This is Beersmith Podcast number 283.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 283, and it's late June 2023. Stan Hieronymus joins me this week to discuss New Zealand hops. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also Beersmith Web, the online version of Beersmith Brewing Software. Beersmith for the Web lets you design great beer recipes from any browser, including your tablet or phone. Edit recipes on the go with access to tens of thousands of recipes, as well as a full suite of recipe building tools that our desktop version has. Try Beersmith's Web today by creating a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. Again, that's beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, a reminder to click that like and subscribe button on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're listening on. Clicking those buttons is a great way to support the show and helps us reach new listeners. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Stan Hieronymus. Stan is the author of For the Love of Hops and has authored a number of other books, as well as Brewing Local, Brew Like a Monk, and Brewing with Wheat. Stan has also penned hundreds of periodicals and is a certified beer judge. Stan, it's a pleasure always to have you on the show.
Thanks for inviting me back. I'm always honored.
It's always good to see you. I guess you've been traveling a lot. At least that's what we were discussing a minute ago.
Yeah, it's funny. When I look back, I think the last year, it's been so long since we spoke. And most recently, we went to New Zealand and were there for hop harvest. So, yeah, there's a fair amount of beer stuff there. But so last fall, I went to Ecuador and got a chance to really learn a lot more about chicha, which is fascinating. I'm not suggesting that American homebrewers start brewing chicha, but understanding the history and seeing what brewers down there are doing to modernize it makes you realize that there is an exploration that can be done looking into what was made with corn pre-Columbian throughout the Americas, but maybe, like I said, modernizing it a bit and imagining how it might have been evolved had we not interrupted it. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, we actually did an episode on that some time ago with another guest, and yeah, it was very, very interesting, some of the innovation going on down there, right, and how they're incorporating a lot of the local ingredients into the beer.
Yeah, that's super.
Yeah. Oh, cool. And then you mentioned recently New Zealand, of course.
Yeah, we were, it was not a beer trip, but we did drink beer, and we did time it to be there during hop harvest. So, you know, I had the opportunity out of 22 days, three of them were spent basically on hop farms, not day, a day of hops, something else a day of hops, something else a day of hops. So had the opportunity to visit farms within the co-op, which is where all the New Zealand hops came from until very recently, and then also to see some of the new operations, which are much larger, and you can see a lot of American influence in them, but not totally American, because you'll also see, you know, when Hop Revolution has two new farms, one of them is they're using wolf pickers, which is what you would see more often in Germany. So a cross section of those things, and it's just a lot going on down there that reflects much of the innovation in much of the rest of the world, particularly the United States.
Interesting. Well, you today, actually, you want to discuss some of the innovation going on in New Zealand. What is making New Zealand kind of a hotbed in the world of hops now?
Well, I think what's making it a hotbed is people are able to get the hops. You know, most of the varieties people are excited about are Nelson Sauvin, Motueka, Riwaka. They've been around for a while, but it was hard to get them. Riwaka, particularly, almost impossible outside of New Zealand. Matt Brindleson at Firestone Walkers referred to it as a white whale. And they were pricier. Now that they're being grown more widely, they become more affordable. You know, it's hard. You'd be looking when you could get Nelson Sauvin, for instance, on Lupulin Exchange. This is for commercial brewers, obviously, but home brewers can do this math. It would be about $30 a pound. Awfully expensive. So what the co-op has done recently is they've released two new varieties that people are getting excited about. One of them is Nectaron, which is going to be more available this year. Super Dillic, pretty low availability. And these are hops that people want to use in, you know, IPAs and variations on IPAs. So they could be a hazy pale ale or something like that. But they are more tropical, fruity. You get guava, you get rhubarb, all of the sexy aromas and flavors that people are excited about.
What's the structure of the hop growing down there? You mentioned a co-op. Are they dominated by a few large companies? Is there more of a small farm organization?
Well, within the co-op, there are almost 30 farms, and they farm about 1,000 acres. So that would amount to about 30 acres per farm. Mm-hmm. And you think about the American Northwest, the average farm, that's Oregon, Idaho, and Washington. I think the average farm is still about 570 acres. And in Washington, the average farm is more than 800 acres.
Wow.
So you could see, and now acreage in New Zealand with these new farms, which are larger, has expanded it. And there's actually not a firm measurement from anybody. And so we talk about I think we could end up with about 3,000 acres under wire. Those are not all producing a lot of them are younger hops, so it'll be a while till full production. So from 1,000 to 3,000 sounds like a lot, mm-hmm. until you realize that, again, in the Yakima Valley, there are singly owned farms. Now they'll have their farms over multiple areas. With more capacity than New Zealand has even today. And also another way to look at that growth is, and we'll get a better idea in just a few weeks when the acreage this year in the Northwest is totaled up by the USDA. But at the American Hop Convention, there was a call for reduction of acreage because there's an excess of some hop varieties. And in fact, if farmers were to do that reduction in acreage, which I would be surprised if it all happens this year, you'd be talking about taking out about 5,000 acres
wow.
of Citra and Mosaic alone.
Wow.
10,000 acres overall. So, in other words, what would come out of Mosaic and Citra is less than is being produced in New Zealand in total.
The total acreage in the United States is obviously what? How much is it?
Over 50,000.
50,000 acres, and we're talking yeah. about ramping up to 3,000 acres in New Zealand?
Yeah,
is that what
exactly.
you're saying?
Exactly. So they will be more available. I was asked on in a webinar recently, if I thought there would be a glut of New Zealand hops. in some cases, it's going to take a while to catch up because people need to get to know these hops, how to use them, you know, what are going to pair with them. Like I said, they're still not going to be super cheap. Some of them, like Ruaca, just doesn't have is not a high yielding hop. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what happens over time, it's hard to say. But certainly if people and some of the hops that you're using in the US are also expensive. So if people start swapping in and out, then that market is not going to be overloaded.
Hmm. Interesting. What's the heritage for these hops? I think they have a common heritage, right?
Mm. So, if you go back, I mean, New Zealand, in terms people with pale skin have only been in New Zealand since the mid 19th century.
Okay.
And the first settlers came from Europe, some came from the UK. They brought hops with them. Those hops did not do very well. So it was what became dominant was when they imported what was known as Cali Cluster, which is a version of Cluster. There are many versions of Cluster, but Cluster is still pretty much Cluster. And you realize that Cluster, 50 years ago in the United States, accounted for 80% of the hops grown.
Wow.
So you can see you've got that similar heritage. And Cluster is clearly a cross of something from either England or the continent, probably England, best guess, related to Golding, and the American wild hop that would have been prominent in the East Coast. So more than likely, that's Lupuloides as opposed to Neomexicanus.
Okay.
So what happens if you take any new variety like Citra? Mm-hmm. Citra is 1/8 probably Lupuloides and 7/8 European. And then in New Zealand, in the 20th century, they had a disease problem, and they brought in Fugl to cross with the Cluster. So you begin with, so you've got that crossing there where you've got some European in it. And that Cluster is a key component. And the feeling from Ron Beetson, who bred most of these hops that we're talking about, is that the Lupuloides is a super important component, but not the only one. So when you blend back in the Lupulus, which comes from Europe, you've got those two sides of it. So you can talk about Motueka and Ruaca, which clearly have a Saaz Cali Cluster in their background. Mm-hmm. But these have been crossed within their nursery now for decades.
Right.
So they become their own unique, but they keep some of that American heritage. So, and I do keep saying so. The compounds that are treasured in a hop, say like Citra, mm-hmm. or Mosaic, are also quite often found in New Zealand hops, where they would not be found in German hops unless they brought in something with American background to create their hybrids.
Hmm. Interesting. And of course, I think we discussed before the American background's important, right? To some degree.
Yeah, that's what's, you know, what people are excited about right now is thiols. After a while, you're going, there must be more to it than thiols. There certainly is more to it than thiols.
Yeah, the geraniol, the lupin, the linalool. There's a whole bunch of things going on there, right?
Yeah, there's both the terpenes are super important, and now you're starting to see more of a focus as people try and rebuild hops, so to speak, the use of isolating out part of terpenes and adding that to the beer. Hmm. I would say a push right now, at least with the way they're thinking about it in New Zealand is they've got a hop that has all of these qualities. So, for instance, Hop Revolution, which is one of the new farms, it's actually two farms, it is in partnership with Crosby in Oregon, which means that Crosby will do the pelleting of their hops, and they'll be using their CGX technology, which is a cryo technology. So you get a hop that, you know, is a similarity to Lupamax from Barthaz, the enriched lupulin pellets from Hopsteiner, and of course the biggest one, which is YCH cryo hops, which are pelletized. That technology is, you're getting that immediately with the New Zealand varieties, where you can use them in concentrated form, which is what the brewers want to do, strictly at the commercial level, because you save an awful lot of beer that is otherwise absorbed by the hop during dry hopping, right, and just becomes an expense.
Yeah. What makes the New Zealand hops so distinct and different from a lot of the hops grown elsewhere?
Well, you begin with that genetic background and the breeding and their focus on aroma. It was, again, you can go back like 30 years or so ago, they had Green Bullet, which was a high alpha hop, and people would, therefore, was a efficient way of bittering, and they were able to export a lot of that. More than about 90% of their hops are exported, so they're really looking to sell their hops to the world. And they recognize you're never going to make money growing alpha hops. It's a commodity, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just, it adds alpha. You don't think about, but you don't think about the difference that you get, say, between Strata and Idaho 7, to pick two newish American varieties. And they wanted to distinguish themselves. So they bred with that in mind. Part of it is their terroir, their landscape. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the hops are grown in a relatively small region, the Nelson region, although there are two new farms just starting up farther south, with the idea, you know, what happens when they get a little farther from the equator. You've got a slightly longer day when you do that. And how might that change the character of the hop? And we're going to have to see how that sorts out.
Is the terroir there different than what we see in the Yakima Valley, where it's fairly dry?
It is more moist, and particularly early. So that impacts things like drying and making sure, because going in, the strig is much wetter, has a lot more moisture in it. So, yeah, that impacts the drying, how you make that work. Certainly a key factor seems to be why they have, there's always a discussion why Yakima flavors generally are more intense than a Roman flavor than you get from Oregon. Oregon's more temperate, more like England, as a matter of fact. So that intensity, is it because you've got more sunlight, more heat, colder winters? They don't have super cold winters in New Zealand, and it does get pretty warm in the hop growing region, but not ridiculously so. So part of the thinking is it's because of the ultraviolet light. So they're at 40 degrees south. Mm-hmm. Of course, so that they are closer to the equator than in the American Northwest. And at 40 degrees south, if you took a comparable UV reading, ultraviolet light, at 40 degrees north, they have 40% more UV. Hmm. So it's, the sun is super intense. And the feeling is, I mean, their fruits have this bright, intense aroma and flavor as well. So it goes across all those things. And what the effort now, it was certainly with some farms, and you know, I think some of this is going to be sorted out. Freestyle, which is one of the new farms, has certainly been at the forefront of this, is trying to say that this is the terroir that the land and the weather give us. So how can we take advantage of that? They picked their Nelson Sauvin later than other farms for the most part. And when I was there, there was some that was hanging that was super late. But on the edges, you couldn't even, it would just crumble. And it was onion garlic. But they're looking to get that extra intensity. So people thinking about picking dates, and this is going on in the U.S. as well, making sure that you're picking the hop at the best maturity dates possible, given the compounds that brewers are interested in.
Interesting. Well, what are the major varieties that are grown today in New Zealand?
Well, the Nelson Sauvin is still the one of greatest interest, and it's hard to talk about price. And then for home brewers, of course, buying them a few ounces at a time, it makes it even less efficient. I would say Nelson Sauvin is at the forefront, particularly with people wanting to make intensely favored IPAs. It continues to be a love it or hate it hop. It has multiple thials, and particularly, and we'll just stick with the initials and numbers. So it has a lot of 3M, 4MP, which Mosaic has, for instance, a good chunk of. It also has some 4MMP and some 3MH. So it gives you a lot of those. And it was named Nelson Sauvin because of Sauvignon Blanc wine grapes. And of course, which they grow quite a bit of those grapes in Nelson. And then the Marlborough region, the famous Marlborough region, is literally next door. So one of those days, at the risk of losing my beer credibility, one of our days between hops, then we went to Marlborough and did some wine tasting, and then I came back to Hop Farms. And again, the feeling in the Marlborough region is the UV is a factor. So if you drink a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc wine, the fruitiness is more intense. Quite often it really pushes the edge of being catty, which is, in other words, it sells like a litter box, which is something you can certainly get from Citra hops, for instance. And so the Nelson Sauvin gives you a lot of white grape and wine-like aromas and flavors.
Interesting.
Motueka, which again is also tropical. Motueka's a high terpene hop, and we sort of move over to the other area when we're talking about thiols is free thiols, which Nelson Sauvin is pretty rich in free thiols, and the hops that have bound thiols.
Right.
And what are you going to do with the bound thiols? You're going to have to use a different yeast. Omega and Berkeley have made a lot more of those yeast available, but they are modified
genetically modified, right?
But, exactly how GMO. That's, like I said, that's a whole another podcast for you to have. Something like Laura Burns.
But some people don't like GMO, obviously. Yeah.
Right, and you can't. I mean, right now, and we'll talk about Phantasm a little bit later, but here Garage Project comes up with Phantasm, a product that needs a yeast that will free the bound thiols in that product, and they don't have access to a yeast like that. Mm-hmm. But there are other things you can do to work on the access. So also, Solomon has K97. That's okay. That doesn't free the thiols at the rate that the Omega and Berkeley yeast do. But it will do something of that. And then White Labs has a new yeast strain. And I should have written down the name. It's maybe called Tropicale. And again, that'll free some of the bound thiols. The New Zealand hops generally have...
a lot of free thiols, right?
They have free, but also a lot of bound. So Waimea, we know, has a lot of bound 3MH. And Waimea is a high alpha, high oil hop, like 16 to 19%
Wow.
Alpha, I think. And the thing is right now, so we got Nectaron, which is new.
Just coming out, yeah.
Yeah, so, well, it's been about, you know, they released it about 3 years ago, but there weren't many acres. And so it's been used by more U.S. commercial breweries last year, and a lot more of it will be available this year. But a key thing, Nectaron is a sister of Waimea. So I think a lot of the characteristics that you're going to see in Waimea, a lot of the compounds that haven't been measured in Nectaron are probably in Waimea. So you wouldn't be surprised to see that Nectaron, where it has, certainly has thiols, some bound, maybe some free. Hmm. And it is, you know, it really, its name means nectar of the gods, and Ron is Ron Beetson. Bred the hop. You can look at Superdelic. That's another one which might be another year away for homebrewers, because there just are not very many acres of it right now. And that's a pretty high geraniol hop.
So are those the two major new ones coming on then?
The new ones are Nectaron and Superdelic.
Right.
I don't know that they'll release another one within the year, but they have a lot in the works. You know, when I was talking to Ron Beetson and then Carrie, the new breeder, you know, they're spitting out numbers. And, you can't write that number down. And then there's one hop that doesn't even have a number yet. So there are going to be more hops coming out of that. And Freestyle has struck a deal with that has some government match funding, which means Freestyle will probably keep some of the hops proprietary, but others will have to go where any hop grower in New Zealand can use those. And the first hop, and this has been commercially, you see a variety of American brewers have brewed with a hop that right now is called Peacherine. It's not guaranteed. That's kind of its code name. Maybe uh-huh. It'll end up with that name. Maybe it won't, as Peacherine would indicate. Got a lot of stone for really interesting hop. I had one at Choice Brothers in Wellington, and it was peachy keen. That's for sure. So that'll be an interesting one, and they'll have more hops down the road as well. Clayton Hops, which we haven't talked about them, they're one of the large farms. They just announced a deal with Plant Food, which is, again, government-funded, and then they'll be helping fund research, and they will have multiple new varieties over the years coming out of that. So you're going to see more varieties, and that's not always the easiest thing to deal with. But one plus is, as breeders and growers are thinking about that, when they don't have a large amount of one variety that's super popular, if they spread that out across the picking window, then they're able to guarantee the quality of each of the cultivars, picking at the right time to process it correctly.
I assume they have a good hop processing set of facilities down there, right? As part of the co-op.
Well, they're getting, you've got the co-op processing. Freestyle has its own pelleting plant, and they take the approach of that Roy Farms does in the Northwest, which is they are pelleting right from the drying floor, so the hops are not put in a bale and hauled around and stuff like that. So you go to most farms, and this is true in the Northwest, certainly, and for Germany or Czech Republic, wherever, most farms are not pelleting their own hops. And certainly you want to, they're the advantage of having central pelleting facilities is they're larger and they got a lot more quality control. But smaller pelleting lines, you know, they come a long ways in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
So you've got Freestyle has their own. Clayton has just now, I don't know that facility, but they were hoping to be processing much of the 2023 crop through their pelleting facility, which I visited, but it wasn't up and running. And then there are some smaller farms, like Eggers Farm, that is also doing their own pelleting. So there are a variety of those things around.
We often group the Australian and New Zealand hops together, but they really aren't quite the same, right? What are some of the differences between Australia and New Zealand grown hops?
Well, yeah. First of all, New Zealand is Galaxy, which is very popular, but as its popularity grew so quickly, there were quite frankly quality control problems, which they have increased their processing capacities to deal with that. But it's still 58% under the production of Galaxy, which when it's on is a great hop.
Uh-huh.
But they recognize they want to spread that out. So you've got Eclipse coming up, and Eclipse was released at the same time as Nectaron.
I'm sorry, you're talking about New Zealand or Australia?
No, Eclipse is an Australian hop.
Okay, I'm sorry. You started saying New Zealand. That's what confused me.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, yeah. All right. The capacity is increasing.
You're talking about Galaxy Australia.
Galaxy from Australia.
Australia, yeah. You said New Zealand.
Processing capacity expanded. So the feeling is that they're a better guarantee of the control. What many commercial brewers and dealers don't like is they can't go make selection. Say, I want the hops from this field. I want this lot from this field, which, of course, selection is a big deal in the U.S.
Yeah.
It wasn't taking place in New Zealand. It's now more likely to take place in New Zealand because they are permitting that. And often think about, so you could say, you know, I want an early pick Nelson Sauvin, which is not going to be as dank, or I want a late pick and I want this big expressive cannabis character, for instance.
Okay. And back to Australia again. You started on Australia, but
So that's and then the third big one there is Vic Secret, and those are all very expressive and can give you tropical aroma and flavor.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't mind bouncing back to New Zealand,
go ahead.
Certainly, you know, of interest to a lot of people. There's a hop. Some growers sell it as Tahiki because they renamed it. Some sell it as New Zealand Cascade. It's a Cascade. I mean, it is Cascade, but it's Cascade grown in New Zealand and has different characteristics. The Rewaka, the white whale, which is going to be easier to get, I think, because a lot more farms are growing it and are taking, although I think I ask at least six growers about their approach to Rewaka, and I got six different answers. When is the best time to start training it? When do you want to get it to the top of the wire? You know, when do you want to pick it? So there's not total agreement there, but Rewaka is in the fingerprint, not about the thiols, which I have not seen analyzed, although it definitely has bound thiols. They did some fingerprinting. And this is, again, within the labs in New Zealand, where they were looking at across 61 compounds. And Rewaka had the most unique compounds of any other hop. So it's got something going on there. It's a combination. And I think that's important. And I'm as guilty at this as anybody, because we'll go, hey, look, this is a high 4-MMP hop, or this is a high geraniol hop. In the case, step back to the United States, because there was just a presentation at the Craft Brewers Conference, and Tom Nielsen from Sierra Nevada was talking about the importance of esterified geraniol compounds. There are like five or six of those. And so you've got El Dorado, which is not a high thiol hop. It has some thiols, but it has unique compounds, including multiple of these esterified geraniol compounds. Something makes those hops unique, and we're not entirely sure at this point what they are. It's really hard to measure them, of course, the thiols, because they are incredibly potent, but they also occur in parts per trillion.
Wow. Well, let's switch over to brewing for a minute. How can you best use some of these New Zealand hops when you're brewing?
It depends what you're trying to
accomplish. Yeah.
Brew. So I think like last summer I had a Kolsch with Brewaka, and it was stunning. But if you were judging a competition, you would say this is not in style for a Kolsch. So it's, you know, what you want. Or if you want something that's got this floral, particularly this floral, just got a, you know, when you right now, when you open a can, for instance, of something like from Hop Butcher for the World from in Chicago, which quite often brews with New Zealand hops, and these are hazy IPAs. You open that can, and that aroma just comes surging out. Mm-hmm. And I had a fresh hop beer with Rewaka from the Eggers Farm, as a matter of fact, and it had been canned that day. And it was just, you know, just the surge, and a lot of us floral, a little geranial, a little rose-like character, some citrus, you know, both a little lemon lime, just a combination of all that. And Rewaka has that. So you think about what you want to use that in. Do you want to use it? You know, you're going to say, I'm making a New Zealand Pilsner. Yeah, you would probably use that. I'm making a German Pilsner. You probably would not. So that's one thing, is what you're looking for. In order, because of the bound thiols, you're looking for ways to get what you can out of the bound thiols, which means maybe a little bit of stuff in the mash hopping. And you want a lot of interaction with yeast, preferably a yeast that is good at freeing thiols.
Mm-hmm. So that gets us back around to some of the ways to free the thiols. And we already talked a little bit about how yeast is very important to do that, and some of the newer yeasts are modified to do exactly that, right?
Right. And mash hopping is another choice in doing that.
Yeah, I find mash hopping very interesting. It's an old technique that was used when I started brewing, for example, but a lot of people discarded it because it's obviously not very efficient.
Correct.
But from what you were describing, it does free some of the thiols, right?
Exactly. That's why the interest in that.
So I guess, is it the higher temperatures? What actually drives the thiols?
Boy, that's...
is it a combination of chemistry going on in the mash?
It's the chemistry that's taking place in the mash and what binds different compounds together.
Interesting. So some of the enzymes, I guess, maybe help break things free?
Right.
Yeah.
It is what you're looking at is different enzymatic activity to free the bound thiols.
Right. So you're going to free some of these thiols, but you're not going to get any of aroma out of the mash hops, and you're going to get a small amount of bitterness, I guess, right?
Right. But you will, some of those compounds will end up in your beer. That's the goal, the point.
Yeah. Interesting. And then you mentioned a product called Phantasm. Maybe we ought to discuss that.
Yeah, so it certainly screams New Zealand. So Phantasm is those Sauvignon Blanc grapes, after they're used to make the wine, taking the leftover skin, drying it, and turning it into a powder.
So I assume the winemakers, obviously, we've discussed, have known about thiols for quite a long time.
Yes, that's
it. And a lot of it comes from the skins of the grapes. So I guess basically they're just using that product to boost the thiol in the beer, right?
Right. Although, so you know, this, the thinking was the Garage Project, which is in Wellington, which is, you know, a good sized brewery, like maybe 30,000 barrels. I'm not positive about that. And they do a lot of interesting research. They make some really nice sour beers. They just won a medal in World Beer Cup for one of their sour. Their mixed fermentation beers are are really nicely integrated, super balanced, and excellent. And you know, and they're, you know, certainly they're looking at the role microbes may play in getting more out of your hops. A lot of forward-looking stuff going on there. So they're the ones that invented Phantasm, so to speak. And they're, you know, well known among American brewers who are at the forefront of hoppy beers. So they're the ones who first got Phantasm in their hands and began brewing with it. And at the outset, which is, you know, not that much more than a year ago, they'd use this product, and you know, and it's costing around $30 a pound. And they're really not getting anything out of it. Not until they begin using dialyzed yeast to say, "Oh yeah, this is how it can work, and this can give us something different in the beer." Now, Phantasm they're working towards doing this where it's available in a liquid form, and you can dose it and begin to just add a little something special in your beer.
So I assume the Phantasm's added before fermentation starts, right?
That's one. Yeah, you do want the interaction with the yeast, yeah.
Right, right.
But you're not going to use it hot side.
No, that makes sense. So you'd add it, I guess, with the yeast, probably, right?
Yeah. So it's the sort of things we see ongoing when you're talking about, you know, like the New Zealand hops. Maybe you want to brew a beer. Does not need to be with only New Zealand hops.
Right.
You know, again, back to Hop Butcher, just because I just had one, they had a beer with New Zealand hops plus Simcoe.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, it added, the Simcoe added a sort of more adept one thing. A little bit different, you know.
The U.S., the New Zealand hops are clearly not the only ones with thiales. A lot of the U.S. hops are free. A lot of thiales.
Well, that does. Well. Yeah. Simcoe was one of the first hops identified as back in the mid aughts.
But in general, a lot of the European hops do not have high levels of thiales, right?
Right. Not unless not free thiales. Saaz surprisingly has bound thiales. But yeah, the European hops. Straight humulus, lupulus, all have no thiales or super low levels of thiales.
Interesting.
Which is not to say that you wouldn't consider using Saaz with Motueka or Ruwaka, and both those hops have Saaz in on their family tree.
Right.
Because it adds that little herbal note.
Right.
And again, something a little different that just adds some depth.
Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts? Have you played with a lot of beers using things like Phantasm plus the thiale-boosting yeast plus the fruity hops, you know, to create something new?
No, I'm too simple for that. I like the old style stuff. What the hop can give you. But I do think the concentrated products are really good, and you can get a more intense beer. You know, it's a small scale. As a small scale brewer, if you had, say, a 3-barrel brew house or a 5-barrel brew house, those savings can be super significant using the concentrated products. At a homebrew level, yeah, actually, you are getting a heck of a lot more beer. You're going to be saving a lot of beer, but I don't. Actually, I'm old enough that, yeah, I do remember people when they got involved with home brewing were like totally driven just to get the highest utilization and so on. But now with hoppy beers, being efficient has not been part of the deal. You know, if you wanted to get intense hoppy flavors, you got to use a lot of friggin' hops.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, one of the questions I had, can you go overboard with these things? Okay, if I start using these, thiale boosting yeast, then I'm putting Phantasm on top of it, then I'm putting a, you know, a high thiol yeast on top of that. Do I get the right balance?
Well, there are two things. First of all, you can end up with something that looks, that tastes only like juice.
Yeah.
Fruit juice. And you got to decide if you want that, in it. And in fact, a good example, and this goes back to, this was a discussion 10 years ago, is, you know, why does 4-MMP act like it does? So you can, if you smell it in a raw form, it's not tropical. What else? I mean, if you smell Citra, it has some tropical character, but that's not necessarily from the 4-MMP. 4-MMP itself in a raw form is more like a tomato plant, black currant, chives. Its interaction with citronellal, probably also some geranium, linalool, all these other compounds in hops. So that isn't a biotransformation. That's a synergy. So the biotransformation is where you get these other ester compounds, slam 4-MMP in there, that comes across as tropical.
Right.
So brewers, this was at a conference. It's a conference actually 2017. No, 2000. Yeah, it was 2017. And ask about it. So the German brewing scientist, actually he was a food scientist, explained when you get an excess of 4-MMP. So if you take geranial, for instance, and just keep pouring in more geranial, it will become, you'll get more of that aroma, more of that citrus and the geranium, those sorts of things. It just becomes more. With 4-MMP, it changes. So you keep pouring in more 4-MMP, that's when you get to the litter box begins to dominate.
Interesting.
So that's not, you can't use too much thiols. So in some of the, because they did a bunch of actually, you know, put this much phantasm in the beer, sent it off to a lab to be analyzed so they know the amount of thiols that were in there, in this case, 3-MH. And they reached a level where all of a sudden they were going, we do not want to drink this. So there are two ways. You can use too much, simply you'll create a beer that Stan doesn't like, which is juice.
Yeah.
Or you can create a beer that nobody likes,
right,
because it stinks.
I'm thinking like esters here, you know, they're nice and peary at the beginning, but then they start to go into turpentine if you go crazy, you know. So there's definitely a balance here. You got to strike the right balance with a beer.
Well, yeah, but, and, you know, what's changing is the balance I like might be different than the newish balance. And as an old guy, I have to be aware of that and say, hey, this is okay. This is what people like. It's okay if you just like juice.
Yeah, but nobody really likes the litter box, is my point.
Yeah, the litter box, on the other hand, is definitely something to avoid.
Yeah. Well, Stan, we're running low on time, but I wanted to get your closing thoughts on New Zealand hops and, of course, the continued push to more and more fruity IPAs, I guess, with thiols and linalool and geraniol and all the other things.
Well, I think the New Zealand hops have, there'll be some excitement because they're new. To many people, there are a lot of ways to use them as beer, as subtle comes back into style, they'll still work in those beers as well, I would say. And they have the advantage to realize that their environment, which we didn't talk about, of course, they don't have any mildews.
Interesting.
Which makes them, that their carbon footprint is naturally smaller, and that's an important thing for brewers to be paying attention to now, because climate change seems to be speeding up, and it's not being kind to many hop varieties, Saaz being one of the premier examples of that.
Well, Stan, appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks again. You keep inviting me. I'll keep coming back.
Always a pleasure to have my friend Stan Hieronymus on. He's the author of For the Love of Hops, as well as Brewing Local, Brew Like a Monk, and Brewing with Wheat. Stan, a pleasure again.
Thanks.
A big thank you to Stan Hieronymus for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also Beersmith Web, the online version of Beersmith Brewing software. Beersmith for the Web lets you design great beer recipes from any browser, including your tablet or phone. Edit recipes on the go with access to tens of thousands of recipes, as well as a full suite of recipe building tools. Try Beersmith Web today by creating a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, a reminder, click that like and subscribe button on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're listening on. Clicking those buttons is a great way to show your support for the show, and it helps us reach new listeners. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.